And we always appreciate you, Mr. Getty.
Thank you.
The next case is United States v. Vargas Soto. Mr. Page, you look familiar.
It please the court. There are two reasons that manslaughter cannot be considered a crime of violence under 18 U.S.C. 16b within the boundaries of this court's precedent. First, in United States v. Chapa Garza, this court held that this definition of crime of violence requires not merely a risk that the offense will feature the use of force, but a risk that the defendant will use force for a particular reason, that is, to complete the offense. In other words, this case requires a risk that the defendant will become frustrated trying to accomplish his criminal goal. The problem is that when an offense's mens rea is recklessness, the offense does not state a criminal goal that the defendant might use force in order to complete. One does not typically begin to accidentally kill somebody and then, when frustrated by the failure of one's accident, use force to complete the job. This court's decision in Perez-Munoz versus Kiesler is not to the contrary. Perez-Munoz involved the defendant convicted of injury to a child, which requires causing injury, and the court found that it was an aggravated felony. But in that case, there was an indictment or a charging instrument that said that the defendant intentionally caused injury. In that case, then, the offense was pared down to the statute's intentional injury prong, and the offense therefore required proof of some criminal goal that the defendant was attempting to accomplish, and therefore some risk that he might use force in order to accomplish that goal. The government's 28J letter points to a handful of cases where defendants use force intentionally, but are reckless as to whether or not it's going to cause death. But those cases are bar fights and people shooting into crowds and recklessly wielding a knife. But these are simply factual scenarios that happen to involve the use of force, not evidence that the elements of the offense of manslaughter create a risk that the defendant will use force to complete the offense. You can compare those kinds of cases to burglary, which is the classic example of a 16B crime of violence. In burglary, the defendant, as the Supreme Court explained in Leocal, enters a house sometimes unaware of whether or not anybody's in there, and therefore takes a risk that they're positioning themselves to have to use force in order to complete the burglary. The risk, therefore, that's described by 16B is not the chance that a random offense prosecuted under the statute will happen to feature the use of force, but the risk of an unanticipated use of force in order to complete the defendant's goal.
Well, let me make sure, I'm sorry, go ahead. Make sure I understand the distinction that perhaps would apply here. The PSR also showed he had been convicted, and I think in the same event, of evading arrest. Would your argument hold up equally well with evading arrest? It seems to me that if you're focusing on the possible need to use force to complete your crime, evading arrest, bouncing off other cars, whatever is necessary to evade, I mean, make sure my assumption is correct. Is it the same offense, the same set of facts?
It is.
When he was trying to evade arrest, would that mens rea be sufficient?
It would, and in fact, I think this court has held that it is. Yeah. So the reason that this would affect the defendant's substantial rights, the problem with the manslaughter conviction is that there is no Shepard document establishing the evading arrest in this case.
There's no what?
There's no Shepard document establishing the evading arrest. There's only the reliance on the PSR.
Would we be able to vacate the sentence if we agree with you and remand for further proceedings that would allow that to be pursued by the government?
There would, and there, and yes, I think that in evaluating the substantial rights prong here, the court's limited to the record that's been developed.
Let me ask
on the court,
counsel. Assuming that we did an analysis and found that this was an error and it's not a doesn't come under A or B. Why is it plain in the light of Supreme Court specifically not answering that question in light of that we apparently have a couple of unpublished opinion, one that goes one way and one that goes another way. Why would it be plain error or obvious error in this particular case?
Well, the fact that this particular statute hasn't been addressed in a published opinion does not render the error unplain. Gratia Cantu, which was the analogous injury to a child statute, was also a novel a treatment of a statute that hadn't been dealt with before under the aggravated felony provision, and this court held that the reasoning of Chapa Garza was sufficient to demonstrate what the outcome had to be.
We have seemingly an unpublished opinion where it wasn't plain to a panel of this court that held that under similar circumstances that this wasn't that this was fit in the B part of the statute.
Well, that was an Oregon statute, and that case was decided after. While Galvan Rodriguez was still good law, and it explicitly relied on Galvan Rodriguez, the UUMV case, which held that an accident, a mere accident, could be considered the use of force. Galvan Rodriguez has been explicitly overruled by Armendariz Moreno, which is another published opinion, albeit brief, which clearly establishes that 16B cannot apply to reckless offenses because it applies the Begay formulation of purposeful, aggressive, and violent conduct. That formulation has been limited, true, by Sykes, but the one principle that has remained unscathed in the purposeful, aggressive, and violent formulation is that offenses that do not involve intentional conduct don't satisfy that test. So even if you were not forced to look at Gratia Cantu and Chapa Garza in those in order to determine whether the error is plain, Armendariz Moreno also makes clear that the error is plain because it sets forth a test that this offense statute plainly doesn't meet.
Well, you've been focusing in response to questions on the first two parts of plain error. It does seem to me that if, in fact, that's the direction we go, we have to deal with the third factor as well as the overarching final consideration. How about those? Why don't you give us your response?
If the court's concern is that the evading arrest might complicate the third and fourth.
Substantial rights and the impact on perceptions. The evading arrest, I don't know if there's anything else, but certainly the evading arrest is part of that analysis, I would think.
It is. I would call the court's attention to Rojas Luna, which I think stands for the proposition that the third and fourth prongs have to be evaluated in light of the record that has been developed before the court, that the fact that there are factors that could support an enhanced statutory maximum referenced in the PSR is not the kind of overwhelming evidence that an enhanced statutory maximum is appropriate. That this court can look at in determining whether or not the third and fourth prong are met. I would also point the court to the seventh note in 2L1.2, which says that when the defendant's 16-level offense is not an aggravated felony, that a downward departure might be appropriate. I'm not going to suggest that the same judge that gave this defendant 15 years is likely to give him a downward departure, but because this court did structure this as a departure rather than a variance explicitly, there is reason to believe that it might be persuaded that it could moderate the extent of its upward departure if it were aware that the 16-level offense manslaughter were not an aggravated felony. In other words, there is on point advice from the Sentencing Commission suggesting that a downward departure might be appropriate if and only if the court finds that manslaughter is not an aggravated felony. I think, to return to the Rojas Luna point, I think the reason that you have to limit yourself to the record that's been developed in order to determine and not speculate about what documents the parties will add to the record in order to evaluate the third and fourth prongs, is that we don't know what those documents will say or what the another party might add to that record.
What is in the PSR about this other? Just is listed as another offense to which he pled guilty or otherwise was convicted?
Yes, and it shows the
sentence.
It shows the sentence, right? So, but there isn't a Shepherd document which it would establish that he was convicted under the portion of 3804, which requires, for instance, a vehicle. And so, right now, the question before the court is whether manslaughter is a crime of violence. Finally, I would like to ask the court to take a look at the substantive reasonableness of the sentence. 15 years is a profoundly long time to sit in jail for the crime of entering a geographic area. I would hazard that this court probably sees very few sentences of 15 years for the crime of illegal reentry. However awful the defendant's criminal history, some cognizance has to be taken of the actus rea for which he is actually being punished. Further, this defendant's sentence involves the death of somebody and a lot of grossly irresponsible and tragic conduct. It does not involve violence. It does not involve sex offenses. It does not involve, or doesn't involve deliberate violence or theft. Substantive reasonableness review is extraordinarily deferential, I concede, but it is not simply a collection of disguised procedural challenges. It's substantive reasonableness. When a sentence is truly disproportionate, I submit that this court has a duty to intervene, and that duty is established by Supreme Court precedent like Gall.
Is there any relevance to the relatively short sentence, plural sentences, he got for these crimes, the evading arrest and the other offense? And I don't recall now what they were, but he was out again to be committing a new offense. Is that relevant in whether this is substantively unreasonable?
The 3-year sentence for evading arrest, which he was paroled and deported, but he received a 3-year sentence, might be relevant. It's could cut both ways. Parties negotiate reduced sentences when there is questions about guilt, or when the offense doesn't appear to merit the longest possible sentence.
What sentence did he get for the manslaughter?
He got 3 years, and I think a year
for
evading.
Concurrent 3-year sentences for those.
He got 1 year on evading.
I understood you then.
Yeah, but everything was concurrent. And he served less than a year. He was paroled. If there's nothing further, I'll.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. McKay?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brian McKay on behalf of the United States. Mr. Vargas contends that the district court plainly erred by treating him as having been convicted of an aggravated felony. Now, the court sentence is correct because Texas manslaughter under the contemporary statute is a crime of violence under Section 16B. But even as Judge Benavidez, as you pointed out, if the court concludes that it is not, the complicated and nuanced analysis required to reach that conclusion reveals that the answer is neither clear nor obvious and thus can't be plain error. Mr. Vargas encourages the court, contrary to the categorical view, to view his conviction as DWI or intoxication manslaughter, and he points to cases applying negligence or lesser mens rea offenses to Section 16B's definition. But that's not what Mr. Vargas was convicted of. Instead, he was convicted and he confessed to having committed manslaughter, that is, recklessly killing someone. Under the categorical approach, we're required to consider whether, by its nature, recklessly killing someone involves a substantial risk that physical force may be used against someone in the course of committing the offense. and the answer to that issue is by no means clear or obvious. Mr. Vargas points to Chapa Garza and suggests that it would naturally and conclusively have pointed the district court to the conclusion that a recklessness homicide cannot be a crime of violence, and that that conclusion is clear. And as the court has pointed out, that that Chapa Garza forecloses such an issue is not clear at all. In fact, just 9 months after deciding Chapa Garza, this court, in an unpublished decision, Ortiz-Irigoyen, concluded that reckless homicide is a crime of violence under Oregon law. Had an objection been made in the district court requiring the court to have conducted this analysis, it would have all...
Was there any substantial difference, or what difference, if any, are you aware of, in the Oregon reckless death statute and the manslaughter statute here involved
that
requires recklessness?
Yes. The contemporary Texas manslaughter statute and the Oregon statute applied in Ortiz-Irigoyen both require reckless homicide. In the case of Oregon, the statute, I believe, says that homicide is manslaughter if it is committed recklessly. Now, had the district court...
Let me stop you there. If all we had, it's never all we have, one case, but if all we had was Chapa Garza, would this issue be foreclosed and would it be plain error?
No, it wouldn't. Because, first of all, Chapa Garza, of course, isn't a recklessness case.
It was the standard announced there seems to suggest some sort of intentional force. I don't think it's at least points in the direction that counsel opposite is going.
There is a reason.
Maybe it's a little bit of an extension. I don't know if you can say. I don't know whether the word is extension or is an application. You would say an extension, and he would say an application.
I think you're correct, but there is a reasonable argument that such a conclusion would follow from the rationale of Chapa Garza. But a couple of things. First of all, I believe that you can't read Chapa Garza as intentional use of force as meaning intentional in the sense of excluding knowing use of force, reckless use of force, or it does seemingly exclude negligent or accidental use of force. But I think the rationale of Chapa Garza is even more questionable after Leocal, in which the intentional use of force that's used in Chapa Garza isn't found in Leocal. And as noted in the briefs, the further lack of clarity on this issue of reckless homicide is propounded by the fact that the Supreme Court hasn't provided an answer in this issue. And in Leocal, the court dealt there with exclusively negligent or lesser mens rea offenses, and as the court noted with opposing counsel, specifically reserved for another day the issue of recklessness. And even though the court cautioned that its analysis didn't go to crimes committed recklessly, its use or its treatment of the term use of force can be instructive here. The court noted that use requires active employment of force, and it distinguished that from accidental conduct. It illustrated this by pointing out that if we say that someone stumbled and fell into someone, you wouldn't normally regard that as the person having used force, as opposed to pushing someone where you would. And the court noted that the term use of force naturally suggests a higher degree of intent than negligent or merely accidental conduct. And acting recklessly is not acting accidentally.
Yeah, but are you employing force? Do you have to? Now, if you recklessly do something that can cause something, is that the same thing as recklessly doing something that actively uses force? In other words, should there be some sort of nexus between the reckless conduct and the actual use of force, or is just some resulting, this is a result-oriented offense in Texas, or is just the result enough that some kind of physical force would have had hitting the tree or colliding with the person is enough? It's just that does the result substantiate the force?
Sure.
Or does the defendant have to have that reckless use of force as opposed to some kind of a description of his general demeanor?
I would say first that the cases cited in the government's 28J letter illustrate that reckless homicide includes, in the ordinary case, the intentional use of force that recklessly causes death. When someone acts recklessly in causing death, they are consciously aware of their conduct and the nature of the conduct, and specifically that it presents a substantial and unjustifiable risk. And even despite knowing that, they engage in that conduct nonetheless. Now, in reply, Mr. Vargas points to a couple of decisions in post-Leocal, and in particular the Third Circuit and the Fourth Circuit, in suggesting that they undercut the government's position here. But respectfully, I submit that instead they show the lack of clarity on this issue. In Oyabanji, the Third Circuit applied what it believed to be considered dicta in Leocal and reached the conclusion that a reckless homicide was really an accidental homicide, and concluded that it was not a crime of violence.
I'm a chemist, and I leave a vial of poison recklessly in the lab or in the public area of some building where I work, and someone touches it and it kills them, or a child drinks it and it causes their death. Did that recklessness use force to cause the death?
I think it is arguable whether it did or it didn't. And I acknowledge that in some instances, Texas manslaughter may be committed by acts of omission, such as failure to secure chemicals or failure to safeguard them. But here, and we know from Perez Munoz that...
Well, let's look at what this guy was charged with. Reckless failed to operate a motor vehicle while failing. That's a failure. That's an omission. Operate a motor vehicle while failing to brake. Operate in excess of posted speed limit. That may be a little more active. And then something about other stuff. And then the reasonable. Operate a motor vehicle at speed not reasonable, which I don't know how the jury's... If it's reasonable, that's one standard, but then overall there's got to be another standard. It's got to be reckless.
Right. And I know the court is referring to the judicial confession underlying.
I guess those were the elements that were... I mean, that was probably what was pled in the state indictment, which is, it looks like something I would have filed if I was filing a civil lawsuit.
it is what Mr. Vargas had admitted to doing. What he admitted to doing was driving a car, which is typically not an accidental act, and doing so in excess of the posted speed limit in speed not reasonable under the circumstances, and he did so recklessly. Those are intentional acts that he committed. And Perez Munoz, of course, tells us that we can...
Intentionally reckless?
He was intentionally acting, and he was consciously disregarding...
He only had to be reckless. He didn't have to be intentional to commit this offense. It had to be a reckless act. There's no requirement that his act be intentional and just be reckless, right?
But he has acknowledged that... I mean, typically, driving a car is not an accidental act, as Leocal contemplates an accidental tripping and falling and pushing somebody in the context of that. To I guess extend the court's example of pushing, certainly you can recklessly push someone. If you were to walk across a crowded room with reckless abandon to go to the door and say, I don't intend to hit anybody, but if someone gets in my way, I'm going to walk so fast that it's going to happen. And despite that, I'm going to engage in my conduct intentionally nonetheless.
Well, it seems to me, on a Leocal, we need to find that this offense involved a person, naturally involved a person acting in disregard of the risk that physical force might be used against another in committing an offense. And it seems that Mr. Page's argument, at least in part, is saying that was not part of what he was trying to do or intending to do, but it is part of what recklessly would result from racing away, however it might be articulated. I mean, Mr. Page has a point. I'm not sure it's a point that survives plain error review, but you are arguing you don't need plain error review, that this directly applies, and even if an objection had been made, this was a proper application of the 16B, correct?
I believe that's correct. I mean, I'm arguing that there is no error, but even if there is, it certainly is not plain. And I think that that's captured in Judge Niemeyer's dissent in Bejarano, the Fourth Circuit post-Leocal case that Mr. Vargas points to, in which Judge Niemeyer pointed out how, unlike a person who accidentally injures another person, someone who acts recklessly in bringing about harm to another is aware of the nature of his conduct and thus can be said to be actively employing the physical force that results in injury to another. And that that dissent, among other things, points out that this is a matter of that is subject to dispute. There are reasonable
views. Isn't that an argument that shows fault? It shows fault, not necessarily an intent or likelihood of his use of force, but some sort of a fault standard. In other words, it's not accident from the standpoint of it's just something that happened that no one's at fault in, but it's a certain level of fault. When people have accidents, they sue. and the standard is reasonable doubt, a preponderance of the evidence the person acted unreasonably, or you get greater damage because you did it willfully or something like, with conscious disregard, almost to the level of willfulness or something like that, you get different damages. But I have a tough time between relating that and something that will where force is intended to be used or will be used, or that there's a likelihood that force will be in some way used. It's tough. I mean, I think maybe because it'd be easier for me. I think it'd be easier to handle it on the basis that it's not plain, given what we've said. But to say outright that there's not a good point here, that there's an error, that's a tougher road to hoe.
I acknowledge that, and frankly, for me, this has been a brain-tangling exercise, which...
We get our brains tangled all the time up here.
Which illustrates why there was no clear or obvious error here. Chapa-Garza, as the court has noted, doesn't mean what Mr. Vargas says. It not only means, but clearly means. This court in Ortiz-Irigoyen showed otherwise. The Supreme Court's decision in Leocal doesn't foreclose this issue. And because to reach the conclusion that Mr. Vargas is asking for would require the extension of precedent, and because there is reasonable dispute and at least two differing reasonable views of reckless homicide and whether it's a crime of violence, there can't have been plain error in this case.
What do other jurisdictions say about this type of mental state in terms of crime of violence?
Your Honor, I haven't done a complete survey. I know that with respect to the Third and Fourth Circuit, Oyabanji and Bejarano seem to capture their analysis. But again, I would reiterate that those decisions, the powerful and I think well-reasoned dissent in Bejarano and the explicit language in Oyabanji, and specifically at page 264, where the court recognized that there are plausible grounds for distinguishing Leocal and coming to the different conclusion, that those cases illustrate that this is a matter that is not clearly settled, that is not obvious, the answer to this question is not obvious, and therefore can't have been plain error where it's not foreclosed here. Unless the court has any additional questions, I would yield the rest of my time.
Thank you. You going to tingle our brains a little more, Mr. Page?
Well, see if I can simplify matters. The reason the error is plain here, first of all, is that Chapa Garza says that a statute involving reckless injury isn't a crime of violence. Why would it be different when the statute merely specifies the kind of injury? The manslaughter statute specifies that recklessly causing death is a violation of that statute. That is not different in any way from the statute at issue in Chapa Garza, which said death or any other kind of injury. The fact that Chapa Garza focused on the act of omission distinction is not a distinction that could plausibly distinguish this case. The indictment in this case doesn't invoke the acts prong of the statute and, in fact, plead certain omissions, as Judge Benavidez pointed out. And even if the court thought that Chapa Garza didn't clearly resolve the case, Armendariz Moreno says that the purposeful, aggressive, and violent test applies to 16B, and Sykes makes clear that while this can't be taken literally in every case, it still, at a minimum, excludes unintentional statutes. Armendariz Moreno is brief. We might have wished that the panel would have shed a little more ink on the issue, but holding is not less binding because it is brief or because we wish it had a longer exposition of its rationale. And the clear import of that is that statutes involving recklessness can't qualify under 16B. Finally, I don't think that Leocal means that the error is not plain here. The fact that the Supreme Court reserved the question of recklessness doesn't change the circuit law that was established in Chapa Garza before that. Every time the Supreme Court addresses an issue and chooses not to speak about another related issue doesn't change the circuit law. It doesn't force this court to then go back and re-decide every related question. With that, I think that there is at least that it is plain that the district court erred, if nothing else, in treating manslaughter as a crime of violence. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both.